Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Courage to be Happy, the Japanese phenomenon that shows you that true contentment is within your power, by Ichiro Kishimi and Fumitake Koga. Read by Graham Malcolm, Noah Galvin, and January Lavoie. Author's Note.
Alfred Adler, the thinker, was 100 years ahead of his time. Though he stands beside Sigmund Freud and Carl Gustav Jung as one of the most important figures in the world of psychology, Adler was for many years a forgotten giant. Since the publication of The Courage to be Disliked, the context of Adler and his school of thought has gone through a remarkable transformation. Adler has been widely known in Europe and America for some time. But now, after our book spent a record-setting 51 weeks as a number one bestseller, having sold millions of copies in South Korea and Japan, I have a strong sense that Adler is present within many people and no longer needs introduction. There is something deeply moving about his ideals being accepted in Asia after the passage of 100 years. The Courage to be Disliked is a kind of map for informing people of the existence of Adlerian psychology and for giving an overview of Adler's ideas. It is a grand map that we put together over the course of several years with the intention of creating a definitive introduction to Adlerian psychology. The Courage to be Happy, on the other hand, is a kind of compass for actually putting Adler's ideas into practice and leading a happy life. And it may also be thought of as a collection of behavioral guidelines showing how one may progress toward the objectives laid out in the first book. In The Courage to be Happy, once more we find the philosopher engaged in a dialogue with the pessimistic youth. 3 years after the conclusion of The Courage to be Disliked, the youth, who has become a teacher with the intention of putting Adler's ideas into practice, calls on the philosopher one last time. Frustrated with Adlerian psychology and angry with the philosopher for introducing him to Adler's ideals, the youth has returned to the philosopher's study to challenge everything the philosopher taught him and insist that he cease to corrupt other young minds with ideals that don't hold up in the real world when interacting with real people. Calmly, the philosopher invites the youth to join him for one final conversation about having courage, not only to take the first step toward happiness, but to continue walking along the path of self-improvement in order to love, be self-reliant, and nurture community feeling. In what way can we make concrete progress on the path to happiness shown in the preceding volume, The Courage to be Disliked? How can we put Adlerian psychology into practice in our everyday lives? And what is that conclusion arrived at by Adler, the biggest choice in life that everyone must make in order to live in happiness? The curtain opens once more on this strong medicine philosophical dialogue. Do you have the courage to climb the stairway of understanding with the youth?
It should have been a more light-hearted and friendly visit.
I hope you will not mind if at some point I visit you here again. Yes, as an irreplaceable friend. And I won't be saying anything more about taking part in your arguments.
Indeed, the youth had blurted out such words on his departure that day. Now, however, 3 years had gone by, and he had arrived at this man's study with completely different intentions. The youth was trembling with the gravity of what he was about to confess, and he felt at a loss as to where to begin. Introduction. People misunderstand Adler's ideas. Philosopher.
Please, tell me, what is going on?
Youth.
You're asking me why I've come to this study again? Well, unfortunately, I'm not here for a simple visit and to rekindle an old friendship. I'm sure you are busy, as am I, so naturally there is a pressing issue that has brought me here once more.
Yes, of course, it would seem so.
I have thought things over. I have worried and obsessed over it all more than is necessary, and re-examined everything completely. In doing so, I arrived at a very serious conclusion and decided to come here to convey it to you. I know you have much to do, but please, give me a moment of your time just for this one evening, because this will probably be my final visit.
What happened?
You haven't figured it out? It's the problem I've been suffering over for so long. Do I give up on Adler or not?
Ah, I see.
I'll get right to the point. Adler's ideas are a farce, an utter farce. Actually, I have to go further and say that they are dangerous, even harmful ideas. While you yourself are certainly free to choose an ideology you wish to adhere to, I would like to ask you, if possible, to please stop spreading these lies once and for all. I've resolved to make this my final visit tonight, as I've said, in the knowledge that I must give up on Adler completely, in your presence, and with this feeling in my heart.
So, was there some event that triggered this?
I will talk this through calmly and in an orderly fashion. First, do you recall that final day 3 years ago when I last saw you?
Of course I do. It was a winter day with glistening white snow all around.
Yes, it was. The night sky was a beautiful blue and there was a full moon. That day, under the influence of Adler's ideas, I took a great step forward. I quit my job at the university library and found a teaching position at my old middle school. I thought I'd like to put into practice a kind of education that was based on Adler's ideas and bring it to as many children as possible.
Isn't that a wonderful decision?
Sure. I was burning with idealism then. I simply couldn't keep such wonderful, world-changing ideas all to myself. I had to get more people to understand them. But whom? I could arrive at only one conclusion. Adults, who are no longer pure and uncorrupted, aren't the ones who need to know about Adler. It's by bringing them to children, who will build a new generation, that his ideas will continue to evolve. That was the mission I had been assigned. The fire inside me was burning so bright, I might well have burned myself.
I see. You can speak of this only in the past tense?
That's right. It's totally history now. But please, don't misunderstand me. I haven't lost hope in my students. And neither have I lost hope or given up with regard to education itself. It's just that I have lost hope in Adler, which is to say, I have lost hope in you.
Why is that?
Well, that's something for you to contemplate and ask yourself. Adler's ideas have no use in actual society and are nothing more than abstract, empty theories, especially that education principle that states, one must not praise and one must not rebuke. And just so you know, I followed it faithfully. I didn't praise and I didn't rebuke anyone either. I didn't give praise for perfect scores on tests or for a thorough job cleaning up. I didn't rebuke anyone for forgetting to do their homework or for being noisy in class. What do you think happened as a result of this?
Your students became unruly.
Completely. But when I think back on it all now, that was only natural. It was my fault for getting taken in by such cheap quackery.
So, what did you do about it?
Needless to say, for the students who were misbehaving, I chose the path of stern rebuke. I know you're probably going to make light of that and tell me it was a foolish solution. But look, I'm not a person who busies himself with philosophy and gets lost in daydreams. I am an educator who deals with real, on-the-ground situations and looks after students' lives and destinies, because the reality right in front of us is never still. It's moving constantly from moment to moment. You can't just sit back and do nothing.
How effective is it?
Naturally, if I rebuke them any further, it doesn't do any good, because they disparage me now. I'm just a softy to them. Honestly, there are even times when I envy the teachers of ages past, when physical punishment was permitted and even standard.
It's not an easy situation.
True. Just so there isn't any misunderstanding, I should add that I haven't been letting my emotions take over or getting angry. I'm only rebuking, in a rational manner, as a last resort for the purposes of education. I guess you could say I've been prescribing an antibiotic medicine called reprimand.
So then you decided to give up on Adler?
Well, I mention that just to give you a clear example. Adler's ideas are certainly wonderful. They shake up your value system and make you feel like the cloudy skies over your head are clearing up, like your life has changed. They would seem to be beyond reproach, a universal truth, even. But the fact is that the only place they hold water is right here, in this study. Once you throw open the door and dive into the actual world, Adler's ideas are just too naive. The arguments they put forward are quite impractical, and nothing but empty idealism. You've just been fabricating a world that suits your purposes here in this room, and losing yourself in daydreams. You don't know a thing about the real world, and the swarming masses of people who live in it.
I see. And then?
An education in which one neither praises nor rebukes. An education that espouses autonomy and leaves students to fend for themselves. That's nothing other than a renunciation of one's professional duties as an educator. From now on, I'm going to face the children in a way that is very different from Adler's. I don't care if it is right or not, because I have no other choice. I will praise, and I will rebuke, and naturally, I will have to mete out harsh punishment as well.
You're not going to quit working as an educator, are you?
Of course not. I will never give up on the path of being an educator, because it is the path I have chosen. It is not an occupation, but a way of living.
It is most reassuring to hear that.
So you think of this as somebody else's problem? If I'm going to continue as an educator, I have to give up on Adler right here and now. If I don't, I'll be renouncing my responsibilities as an educator and abandoning my students. Well, what is your response to that?
First, allow me to make a correction. You used the word truth earlier, but I am not presenting Adler as an absolute, immutable truth. One might say that what I am doing is giving a prescription for eyeglass lenses. I believe there are many people whose fields of vision have been broadened as a result of these lenses. On the other hand, there are probably those who say their vision has become even cloudier than before. I do not try to force the lenses of Adler's ideas on them.
Oh, so you run away from them?
No. Let's look at it this way. No other form of thought is as easy to get wrong and as hard to get right as Adlerian psychology. The majority of those who say, "I know Adler," misunderstand his teachings. They do not possess the courage to approach a true understanding, and they do not try to look directly at the landscape that spreads out beyond this way of thinking.
People misunderstand Adler?
That's right. If someone comes into contact with Adler's ideas and is immediately moved very deeply and says, "Life is easier now," that person is grossly misunderstanding Adler. Because when one truly understands what Adler is demanding of us, one is likely to be shocked by its severity.
So, you're saying that I, too, misunderstand Adler?
Yes. From everything you have been telling me, it would seem so. You are certainly not alone in this, however. There are many Adlerians, practitioners of Adlerian psychology, who misunderstand him at the outset and then climb the stairway of understanding. It would seem that you haven't actually found the stairway that you should climb yet. I didn't find it right away either when I was young.
Huh. You had a period when you were lost, too?
Yes, I did.
Then I want you to teach me. Where is the stairway to understanding or whatever it is? What do you mean by stairway, anyway? Where did you find it?
I was fortunate because I was a house husband in the midst of raising a young child when I came to know Adler.
What do you mean?
Through my child, I learned Adler, and together with my child, I was able to practice and thus deepen my understanding and obtain positive proof of Adler.
So, that's what I'm asking you to tell me. What did you learn? And what is this positive proof you obtained?
In a word, it was love.
What did you say?
You don't really need me to say it again, do you?
What a laugh! So now it all boils down to love? You're saying that if I want to know the real Adler, I have to know about love?
You laugh at this word, but you do not yet understand it. The love Adler speaks of is the harshest and most courage-testing task of all.
Oh, please. If you're just going to preach about neighborly love, I don't want to hear it.
Just now, you stated that you have reached a dead end in your role as an educator, and as a consequence, you distrust Adler. Then you are eager to tell me that you are denouncing Adler and that you don't want me to talk about him anymore, either. Why are you so upset? I suppose you felt that Adler's ideas were something like magic, as if you could just wave a wand, and without further ado, all your wishes would be granted. If that is the case, you should give up on Adler. You should give up the mistaken images of Adler that you have embraced and get to know the real Adler.
No, you're wrong. In the first place, I have never expected Adler to be magical or anything like that. And second, as I think you yourself once said, anyone can be happy from this moment onward.
Yes, I certainly did say that.
But aren't such words a perfect example of magic? You're warning people, don't be fooled by that counterfeit money while pushing other counterfeit money. It's a classic swindler's trick.
Anyone can be happy from this moment onward. This is an undeniable fact, not magic or anything of the sort. You and everyone else can take steps toward happiness. But happiness is not something one can enjoy by staying where one is. One has to keep walking along the path one has embarked on. It is necessary to be clear on this point. You took the step. You took a big step. Now, however, not only have you lost courage and let your feet come to a halt, you are trying to turn back. Do you know why?
You're saying I don't have patience.
No. You have not yet made the biggest choice in life. That's all.
The biggest choice in life? What do I have to choose?
I said it earlier. You must choose love.
You expect me to understand that? Please, don't try to escape into abstraction.
I am serious. The issues you are now experiencing all stem from the single notion of love. The issues you have with education, and also the issue of the kind of life you should lead.
All right. This seems like something worth refuting. Now, before we get into a full-fledged discussion, there is one thing I'd like to say. There is no doubt in my mind that you are a modern-day Socrates. However, it's not his school of thought that I'm referring to, but his crime.
His crime?
Apparently, Socrates was sentenced to death on the suspicion of having tempted and corrupted the youth of the ancient Greek city-state of Athens, right? He subdued his disciples, who were appealing to him to escape from prison, and then drank a poisoned tea and took leave of this world. It's interesting, isn't it? If you ask me, you, who espouse the ideas of Adler here in this ancient capital, are guilty of exactly the same crime. In other words, you are tempting and corrupting naive youth with deceitful words.
You are saying that you were taken in and corrupted by Adler?
That is precisely why I resolve to visit once more before I part ways with you for good. I don't want to create any more victims. Philosophically speaking, I must silence you once and for all.
Well then, it's going to be a long night.
But let's settle this tonight, before daybreak. There is no need for me to keep calling on you after this. Will I climb the stairway of understanding, or will I tear down that stairway of yours and abandon Adler once and for all? It'll be one or the other. There's no in-between.
All right. This may be our last dialogue. No, it seems we will have to make it our last, no matter what.
Part 1. That bad person and poor me. Little had changed in the philosopher's study since the youth's visit there 3 years before. A partially written manuscript lay in a loose bundle on the well-used desk. On top of it, perhaps to prevent the papers from being blown about by the wind, lay an old-fashioned fountain pen ornamented with gold inlay. It all felt familiar to the youth. It was almost as if he were in his own room. He noticed several books he owned, including one he had just read a week earlier. Gazing wistfully at the bookshelf, which took up an entire wall, the youth let out a great sigh.
I mustn't get too comfortable here. I've got to keep moving forward.
Is Adlerian psychology a religion?
Before coming to the decision to visit you once more today, that is to say, before making the firm resolution to abandon Adler, I went through a great deal of distress. It troubled me more than you can imagine. That's how attractive Adler's ideas were to me. But the fact is that at the same time that I was attracted to them, I was harboring doubts all along. And those doubts concerned the name Adlerian psychology itself.
What do you mean?
As the name Adlerian psychology indicates, Adler's ideas are regarded as psychology. And as far as I am aware, psychology is essentially a science. When it comes to the opinions put forth by Adler, however, there are aspects that strike me as decidedly unscientific. Of course, as this is an area of study that deals with the psyche, it might not be completely expressible in mathematical form. That I understand perfectly well. But the problem, you see, is that Adler talks about people in terms of ideals. He's offering up the same kind of cloying sermons that Christians do when they preach about neighborly love. Which brings me to my first question. Do you think of Adlerian psychology as a science?
If you are speaking of a strict definition of science, that is to say, a science that has falsifiability, then no, it is not. Adler declared his psychology to be a science, but when he began talking about his concept of social feeling, many of his colleagues parted ways with him. Their judgment was much like yours. That sort of thing isn't science.
Right. That's a natural response for anyone who is interested in psychology as a science.
This is an ongoing area of debate, but Freud's psychoanalysis, Jung's analytical psychology, and Adler's individual psychology all have aspects that come into conflict with such a definition of science in that they do not have falsifiability. This is a fact.
Okay, I see. I've brought my notebook with me today. I'm going to get this down in writing. That, strictly speaking, it is not science. Now, to my next question. 3 years ago, you referred to Adler's ideas as another philosophy, did you not?
You are correct. I did. I think of Adlerian psychology as a way of thinking that follows in the same vein as Greek philosophy, and that is itself a philosophy. I think the same way about Adler himself. Before regarding him as a psychologist, I see him as a philosopher. He is a philosopher who put his expertise to practical use in clinical settings. This is my perception.
All right, so here's my main point. I thought hard about Adler's ideas, and I really put them into practice. I wasn't skeptical about them. Rather, it was as if those ideas filled me with a feverish passion, and I believed them with all my heart. The thing is, whenever I have tried to practice Adler's ideas in an educational setting, the opposition has been overwhelming. I have been opposed not only by the students, but by the other teachers around me. But if you think about it, that makes sense, because I was presenting an approach to education based on a value system that is completely different from theirs, and attempting to put it into practice there for the first time. And then I happened to recall a certain group of people, and I superimposed their circumstances onto mine. Do you know who I'm talking about?
Well, no, I don't. Who could it be?
The Catholic missionaries who forayed into the heathen lands during the Age of Discovery.
Ah.
Africa, Asia, and the Americas. Those Catholic missionaries journeyed into strange lands where the languages, cultures, and even gods were different, and they went around espousing the teachings they believed in. Just like me, who took my post to espouse the ideas of Adler. The missionaries, though they often succeeded in propagating their faith, also experienced oppression and were sometimes even executed by barbaric methods. One would think it common sense that such people would simply be turned away. But if so, how on earth could these missionaries have succeeded in preaching a new God to the inhabitants of the places they visited and making them give up their native beliefs? It must have been work of considerable difficulty. Craving to know more, I ran to the library.
But that's...
Wait, I'm not finished. So, while I was poring over various writings on the missionaries of the Age of Discovery, another interesting thought occurred to me. When it comes down to it, isn't Adler's philosophy a religion?
Interesting.
Because it's true, isn't it? The ideals Adler talks about are not science. And to the extent that they are not science, in the end, it is just a question of one's level of faith, of either believing or not believing. So, again, it's just about one's feeling. It is true that from our point of view, people who don't know Adler may seem like savage primitives who believe in false gods, and so we feel that we must teach them the real truth and save them as quickly as possible. However, it may be that from their vantage point, we are the ones who are primitive worshippers of wicked gods. Maybe we are the ones who need to be saved. Am I wrong?
No, you're quite right.
Then tell me, what is the difference between Adler's philosophy and religion?
The difference between religion and philosophy is an important subject. If you just rule out the existence of God and think about it then, the discussion will be easier to understand.
Ah, what do you mean?
Religion, philosophy, and science all stem from the same questions. Where do we come from? Where are we? And how should we live? In ancient Greece, there was no division between philosophy and science, and the Latin root of the word science is scientia, which simply means knowledge.
Fine, that's how science was back then, but I'm asking about philosophy and religion. What is the difference between them?
It would probably be better to clarify their points of commonality first. Unlike science, which limits itself to objective fact-finding, philosophy and religion also deal with human ideas of truth, good, and beauty. This is an extremely important point.
I know. And philosophy and religion delve into the human psyche. But where, then, are the boundary lines and points of difference between the two? Is it just that single question of whether God exists?
No. The most important point of difference is the presence or absence of story. Religion explains the world by means of stories. You could say that gods are the protagonists of the grand stories that religions use to explain the world. By contrast, philosophy rejects stories. It tries to explain the world by means of abstract concepts that have no protagonists.
Philosophy rejects stories?
Or think of it this way. In our search for truth, we are walking on a long pole that extends into the darkness. Doubting our common sense and engaging in continual self-doubt, we just continue to walk on that pole without any idea of how far it may go. And then, from out of the darkness, one hears a voice inside saying, "Nothing further lies ahead. Here is truth." So, some people stop listening to their internal voice and stop walking. They jump down from the pole. Do they find truth there? I don't know. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But stopping in one's steps and jumping off the pole midway is what I call religion. With philosophy, one keeps walking without end. It doesn't matter if there are gods or not.
Then this walking without end philosophy doesn't have any answers?
In the original Greek, philosophia has the meaning love of wisdom. In other words, philosophy is the study of the love of wisdom, and philosophers are lovers of wisdom. Conversely, one could say that if a person were to become a complete wise man who knows all there is to know, that person would no longer be a lover of wisdom or philosopher. In the words of Kant, the giant of modern philosophy, we cannot learn philosophy. We can only learn to philosophize.
To philosophize?
That's right. Philosophy is more of a living attitude than a field of study. Religion may convey all under the name of God. It may convey an all-knowing, almighty God and the teachings handed down by that God. This is a way of thinking that conflicts fundamentally with philosophy. And someone who purports to know everything, who has stopped in their path of knowing and thinking, regardless of their belief in the existence or non-existence of God, or even the presence or absence of their faith, is venturing into religion. That is my view on the matter.
In other words, you still don't know the answers?
No, I do not. The instant we feel that we know about the object, we want to seek beyond it. I will always think about myself, other people, and the world. Therefore, I will not know without end.
That answer is philosophical, too.
Socrates, in his dialogues with the self-described wise men, known as the Sophists, arrived at the following conclusion. I, Socrates, know that my knowledge is not complete. I know my own ignorance. The Sophists, on the other hand, those would-be wise men, intend to understand everything and know nothing of their own ignorance. In this respect, my knowledge of my own ignorance, I am more of a wise man than they are. This is the context of Socrates' famous statement, I know that I know nothing.
Then what can you, who have no answers and are ignorant, impart to me?
I will not impart. Let's think and walk together.
Ah, to the end of the pole, without jumping off?
That's right. Keep inquiring and keep walking without limit.
You're so confident, even though you say that sophistry won't hold water. All right, I'm going to shake you down off that pole.
The objective of education is self-reliance.
Well, where should we begin?
The problem that requires my urgent attention right now is education. So I'll expose Adler's contradictions with a focus on that. Because there are all manner of aspects of Adler's ideas that, at their core, are incompatible with education.
I see. That sounds interesting.
In Adlerian psychology, there is a way of thinking called separation of tasks, right? All sorts of things and events in life are regarded from the viewpoint of whose task is this, and divided into one's own tasks and other people's tasks. Say, for example, that my boss doesn't like me. Naturally, it doesn't feel good. It would be normal to make some effort to be liked by him and seek his approval somehow. But Adler considers that to be wrong. What kind of judgment do other people, in this case my boss, pass on my speech and conduct and on me as a person? That is the boss's task, other people's tasks, and it is not something I can control. No matter how much I try to be liked by him, my boss might just continue to dislike me. On this point, Adler says, you are not living to satisfy other people's expectations. And further, other people are not living to satisfy your expectations. Don't be afraid of who might be watching. Don't pay attention to other people's judgment. And don't seek recognition from others. Just choose the path that is best for you and that you believe in. Furthermore, you must not intervene in other people's tasks, and you must not allow others to intervene in your tasks either. To those who are new to Adlerian psychology, this is a concept that has a great impact.
True. Being able to carry out the separation of tasks dramatically reduces one's interpersonal relationship problems.
You also said this. There is an easy way to determine who has which task. I should think, who ultimately is going to receive the end result brought about by that choice? I'm not getting it wrong, am I?
No, you are not.
The example you use, then, was that of studying for a child who does not study. His parents are anxious about his future and yell at him to hit the books. But who is going to receive the end result brought about by not studying? That is to say, that he won't be able to get into the desired school, or that it will be more difficult for him to find a job. No matter how you look at it, it's the child himself, not the parents. In other words, studying is the child's task and is not an issue in which the parents should intervene. Am I doing okay so far?
You are.
Now, this is where a major doubt arises. Studying is the child's task. One must not intervene in the child's tasks. But if so, then what is this thing we call education? What is this occupation we are engaging in as educators? Because if one abides by your line of reasoning, we educators who push children to study are just a gang of trespassers who intrude on their tasks. Now, how can you answer that?
Okay, well, this is a question that comes up on occasion when I discuss Adler with educators. Studying is certainly the child's task. No one is permitted to intervene there, not even the parents. If the separation of tasks Adler speaks of is interpreted in a one-dimensional way, all forms of education become interventions into other people's tasks and thus reprehensible conduct. In Adler's time, however, there was no psychologist more concerned with education. To Adler, education was not simply a core task, it was also the greatest hope.
Can you be more concrete?
For example, in Adlerian psychology, counseling is thought of not as treatment, but as a place for re-education.
Re-education?
That's right. Counseling and childhood education are essentially the same. The counselor is an educator, and the educator is a counselor. It is fine to think of it in this way.
I didn't know that. I had no idea I was a counselor. What on earth is that supposed to mean?
This is an important point. Let's straighten things out as we continue the discussion. First, what is the intended objective of education, both at home and at school? What is your view on this?
It's not something I can convey in just a few words. The cultivation of knowledge through scholarship, the attainment of social skills, the development of human beings who respect justice and who are sound in mind and body.
Yes, all these are important, but let's look at the bigger picture. What does one want children to become as a result of one's providing them with an education?
One wants them to become independent adults?
Right. The objective of education, in a word, is self-reliance.
Self-reliance. Well, I guess you could put it that way.
In Adlerian psychology, all people are regarded as beings who live their lives with the desire to escape from their helpless conditions and improve themselves. That is to say, in the pursuit of superiority. The toddling baby learns how to stand on two legs, acquires language, and becomes able to communicate with the people around him. In other words, what all people are seeking is freedom from their helpless and unfree conditions and self-reliance. These are fundamental desires.
So education is what promotes this self-reliance?
Exactly. And for children to both grow physically and become socially self-reliant, there are all manner of things that they need to know. They need the social skills and the sense of justice you mentioned, and they probably need knowledge and other things too. And of course, the things they do not know must be taught to them by other people who do. The people around them must give their assistance. Education is not intervention, but assistance towards self-reliance.
It sounds to me like you're desperately trying to rephrase things.
For example, how would it be if one were thrown into society without knowing any traffic rules, without knowing the meaning of red lights and green lights, or if one had no car driving skills and found oneself behind the wheel? Naturally, there are rules to be learned here and skills to be attained. This is an issue of life or death, and, moreover, of putting other people's lives in danger as well. One could also put it the other way around and say that if there were no other people left on Earth and you were the only person alive, there would not be anything you would have to know, and education would not be necessary either. You would not have any need for knowledge.
It's because of other people and society that there is knowledge that should be studied?
Yes. Knowledge, here, refers not only to scholarly studies, but includes the knowledge that people need to live happily. In short, how one should live within a community. How one should interact with others. How one can locate one's proper place in that community. To know me and to know you. To know the true nature of a person and to understand the way in which a person ought to live. Adler referred to such knowledge as human knowledge.
Human knowledge? I've never heard that term before.
I don't suppose you would have. This human knowledge is not the kind of knowledge that is gained from books. It is something that can only be learned by actually being engaged in relationships with other people. In that sense, one could say that the school, in which one is surrounded by large numbers of other people, is a more meaningful place of education than the home.
So you're saying that the key to education is this thing you call human knowledge?
That's right. It's the same with counseling. The counselor assists the client in gaining self-reliance. And they think together about the human knowledge that is necessary for self-reliance. Do you recall the objectives put forth by Adlerian psychology that we were discussing last time? The behavioral objectives and the psychological objectives?
Yes, I remember them. There are two objectives for behavior. One, to be self-reliant. Two, to live in harmony with society. And there are two objectives for the psychology that supports these behaviors. One, the consciousness that I have the ability. Two, the consciousness that people are my comrades. So, briefly put, you are saying that these four things are valuable, not only in counseling, but in an actual educational setting?
And they are no less valuable to us adults with our general feelings of how hard life is. Because there are so many adults suffering in social settings who are unable to attain these objectives. If one is left behind the objective of self-reliance, whether in education, counseling, or job coaching, very quickly one will end up forcing things. We must be aware of the roles we are playing, whether we are letting education fall into a kind of trap of compulsory intervention or limiting ourselves to a self-reliance stimulating assistance. It is something that depends on the approach of the person who is doing the educating, counseling, or coaching.
It would certainly seem so. I get it, and I agree with these lofty ideals, I really do, but look, you've already tried that trick on me, and it won't work anymore. Whatever we talk about, it always turns into abstract idealism in the end. It just turns into me listening to these big feel-good words of yours and thinking I understand. But my issues aren't abstract ones. They're actually quite concrete. Instead of all these empty theories, let's hear a grounded, practical theory. Concretely, what sort of step can I take as an educator? That most important concrete first step. You've been dodging that point all along, haven't you? What you're talking about is such a faraway thing. It's as if you're always going on about some landscape far in the distance and trying not to look at the mud at your feet.
3 years earlier, the youth had been filled with astonishment and doubt on hearing the ideas of Adler conveyed by the philosopher, and he had expressed his opposition to them with the fiercest emotion. It was different this time, though. He had a sufficient understanding now of the framework of Adlerian psychology, and moreover, he had gained actual experience in society. One might even say that, in the sense that he had on-the-job experience, he was the one who had learned more. This time, the youth had a clear plan.
Focus not on the abstract, but on the concrete. Not on theory, but on actual practice. And not on ideals, but on reality. That is what I want to know. And also, where Adler's weaknesses lie.
Respect is seeing people as they are.
Concretely then, where should we begin? When education, coaching, and assistance adopt self-reliance as their objective, where is the point of entry? To be sure, this may be an area of concern, but there are clear guidelines here.
I'm all ears.
There is only one answer. Respect.
Respect?
Yes. No other point of entry is possible in education.
Another surprising answer. So, in other words, what you're saying is respect your parents, respect your teachers, and respect your boss?
No. First of all, for example, in a class, you must have respect for the children. Everything starts from there.
I do? For these kids who can't be quiet and listen to someone for even 5 minutes?
Yes. It could be a relationship between parent and child or within a company organization, but it doesn't matter. In any kind of interpersonal relationship, it is the same. Initially, the parent respects the child and the boss respects his subordinates. The roles are such that the person standing on the teaching side has respect for the person standing on the learning side. Without respect, no good interpersonal relationships can come about, and without good relations, one's words will not reach anyone.
You're saying I should respect each and every problem child?
Yes, because at the root of it is respect for people. One's respect is not limited to specific others, but extends to other people of all kinds, from family and friends to unknown passers-by, and even to people in other countries whom one will never meet as long as one lives.
Ah, another lecture on morality. Or else it's religion. Well, I've got to say, you're giving me a good opening. It's true that morality is included in the curriculum in school education, that it has such importance. And I concede that there are many people who believe in those values. But consider this. Why is it even necessary to talk sense into children about morality? It's because children are immoral beings by nature, as are all humans. Heck, what is respect for people anyway? Moreover, within both of us, in the very depths of our souls, there drifts the repulsively putrid stink of immorality. You preach on what is moral to immoral people. I am seeking morality. This truly is intervention, nothing less than force. The things you say are full of contradictions. I'll say it again. Your idealism will have no effect at all in an actual situation. And besides, how can you expect me to respect these problem children?
Then I will say it again, too. I am not preaching morality. But the other point is that, especially with people like you, I have to help you to understand and to actually practice respect.
Well, enough of that already. I don't want to hear empty theories that reek of religion. I'm asking you for concrete examples that are practicable tomorrow.
What is respect? Here is one definition. Respect denotes the ability to see a person as they are, to be aware of their unique individuality. These are the words of the social psychologist Erich Fromm, who moved from Germany to America to escape Nazi persecution around the same time as Adler.
The ability to be aware of their unique individuality?
Yes. One sees that person who is irreplaceable and utterly unique in the world, just as they are. Moreover, Fromm adds, respect means the concern that the other person should grow and unfold as they are.
I don't understand.
Not trying to change or manipulate the other person who is right there in front of you. Accepting that person as they are without setting any conditions. There is no greater respect than this. Then, on being accepted by another person as one is, one is likely to gain a great courage, and respect may also be regarded as the starting point of encouragement.
No way. That is not the respect I know. Respect is a kind of emotion akin to yearning, a sort of imploring that one can rise to the occasion.
No, that is not respect, but fear, subordination, and faith. It is a state in which one fears power and authority and worships false images without seeing anything of the other person. The Latin respicio, which is the root of respect, has the connotation of seeing. First of all, one sees the person as they are. You have not seen anything yet, and neither have you tried to see. Place value on the person being that person without pushing your own value system on them. And further, assist in their growth or unfolding. That is precisely what respect is. In the attitude of trying to manipulate or correct another person, there is no respect whatsoever.
So, if I accept them as they are, will these problem children change?
That is not something you can control. Maybe they will change, and maybe they will not, but as a result of your respect, each of the students will accept themselves for being who they are and regain the courage to be self-reliant. There is no doubting this. Whether they use their regained courage is up to each student.
So that's the separation of tasks?
That's right. You can lead them to water, but you can't make them drink. No matter how gifted you are, as an educator, there is no guarantee that they will change. But it is precisely because there is no such guarantee that one has unconditional respect. First, you have to start, without setting any conditions whatsoever, and regardless of what the anticipated results might be, it is you who take the first step.
But nothing will change that way.
In this world, no matter how powerful one is, there are two things that cannot be forced.
What are they?
Respect and love. For example, let's say the person at the top of a company organization is an authoritarian despot. The employees will follow his orders, certainly, and they will probably display obedient behavior. But that is submission based on fear, without an iota of respect. He can shout, "Respect me," but none of them will comply. In their hearts, they will just grow more and more distant from him.
Yes, I'm sure they will.
On top of that, if no mutual respect exists, then there is no relationship as human beings either. An organization like that is just assembling groups of humans to function as its nuts and bolts and gears. It can carry out machine-like labor, but no one else can do the human work.
Okay, enough roundabout talk already. So, basically, what you're saying is that I'm not respected by my students, and that's why the classroom gets out of control?
If there is fear, even for a short time, it is unlikely for there to be any respect. It's only natural that the class will get out of control. You just stood by idly as it developed, and now you resort to authoritarian measures. You use power and fear to try to make them do your bidding. Maybe you can expect that to be effective for a while. Maybe you'll feel relieved that they really seem to be listening to you now. However,
they're not hearing a single word that comes out of my mouth.
That's right. The children are not obeying you. They are only submitting to authority. They do not entertain the slightest thought of understanding you. They just cover their ears and shut their eyes and wait for the storm of your rage to pass.
You really hit the nail on the head.
You fall into this vicious cycle because you fail to take the initial step of respecting the students yourself, of respecting them unconditionally.
So, because I failed to take that step, there's nothing I can do that will get through to them?
That's right. You have been shouting to an empty room. There's no way they can hear you.
Okay, fine. I understand that. There's still so many points I need to refute, but I'll accept this for the time being. Now, supposing that your approach is the right one, that relationships are built on the basis of respect, how then does one show respect? You're not telling me to put on a pleasant smile and say, "Hey, I respect you," are you?
Respect is not something that comes about with words. And whenever an adult tries to cozy up to them in such a way, the children quickly detect the lie or calculation. The moment they think this person is lying, respect isn't possible anymore.
Okay. Okay, you've hit the nail on the head again. But what are you suggesting I should do? Because there's actually a major contradiction in the way you're talking about respect right now.
Oh? What contradiction is that?
Start from respect, the philosopher was saying. And that respect is not only the foundation on which education is built, but it is also the base of all interpersonal relationships. Certainly, one doesn't pay much attention to the words of people one doesn't respect. There were aspects of the philosopher's arguments that the youth could agree with. But the argument that one had to respect all other people, that even the problem children in his classroom and the villains at large in society were all worthy of respect, that was something he opposed vehemently.
He's dug his own grave. He's made a contradiction that can't be overlooked. So this is something I must do, after all. I have to metaphorically seal this Socrates in his cave.
The youth pondered this for a moment, and then continued at full speed. Have concern for other people's concerns.
Don't you see? Earlier, you said, respect can never be forced. Sure, that is probably the case. That I can agree with wholeheartedly. But then, in the same breath, you tell me to respect the students. Isn't it funny? You're trying to force me to do something that apparently can't be forced. If you don't call that a contradiction, then what is?
It is true that if you pick out just those statements on their own, they might sound contradictory. But look at it this way. Respect is a ball that comes back to you only from the person to whom you pass it. It's just like throwing a ball at a wall. If you throw it, it might come back to you, but nothing is going to happen if you just face the wall and shout, "Give me the ball!"
No way. I'm not going to let you get away with half-baked metaphors. Give me a proper answer. If I'm the one throwing that ball of respect, where does it come from? The ball doesn't just come out of nowhere.
All right. This is an important point about understanding and practicing Adlerian psychology. Do you recall the term social feeling?
Of course. Though I wouldn't say I understand it completely.
Yes, it's a rather difficult concept. Let's consider it more thoroughly another time. For the time being, though, I would like you to recall Adler's use of the term social interest when translating the original German term for social feeling into English. This social interest means our concern for society, or more simply, our concern for the other people who make up society.
So it's different in the original German?
Yes. The German term is Gemeinschaftsgefühl, which combines Gemeinschaft, meaning social relations or community, with Gefühl, sense or feeling, which I translate as social feeling. If one were to give it an English translation that is more faithful to the original German, one might call it community feeling or community sense.
Well, I'm not particularly interested in such academic talk, but what about it?
Think about it for a moment. Why, when Adler introduced this idea to the English-speaking world, did he choose social interest instead of social feeling, which is closer to the German? There is an important hidden motive here. Do you remember how I said that when Adler first put forward the concept of social feeling during his Vienna period, many of his colleagues parted ways with him? That he was opposed and ostracized by people who said that such stuff wasn't science, and that he had introduced the problem of value into the otherwise scientific field of psychology?
Yes, I remember that.
It is likely that through this experience, Adler understood sufficiently well the difficulty of getting people to understand social feeling. So when it came time to introduce the concept to the English-speaking world, he replaced social feeling with behavioral guidelines that were based on actual practice. He replaced the abstract idea with something concrete. And these concrete behavioral guidelines may be summarized with the words concern for others.
Behavioral guidelines?
Yes. To get away from one's attachment to oneself and to have concern for other people. If one progresses in accordance with these guidelines, one arrives at social feeling as a matter of course.
I haven't the faintest idea what you're talking about now. Your argument has already become abstract again. The very idea of there being behavioral guidelines for having concern for other people. Speaking concretely, what should one do and how?
Here, it would do well to recall that quote from Erich Fromm. Respect means the concern that the other person should grow and unfold as they are. Without negating anything or forcing anything, one accepts and values the person as they are. In other words, one protects and one has concern for another person's dignity. Do you see where that concrete first step lies?
No. Where?
This is a quite logical conclusion. It lies in having concern for other people's concerns.
Other people's concerns?
For example, the children enjoy playing in a way that is completely beyond your understanding. They get absorbed with utterly inane, childish toys. Sometimes they read books that are offensive to public order and morals and indulge in video games. You know what I am referring to, yes?
Sure. I see such things almost every day.
There are many parents and educators who disapprove and try to give them things that are more useful or worthwhile. They advise against such activities, confiscate the books and toys, and allow the children only what has been determined to have value. The parent does this for the child's sake, of course. Even so, one must regard this as an act that is completely lacking in respect and that only increases the parent's distance from the child, because it is negating the child's natural concerns.
Okay, so I should recommend vulgar pastimes?
One does not recommend anything from where one stands. One only has concern for the children's concerns. Try to understand just how vulgar their pastimes are from your point of view, and what they really are, first of all. Try them yourself, and even play together on occasion. Rather than simply playing with them, enjoy the activity yourself. If you do, the children may at last have the real feeling that they are being recognized, that they are not being treated as children, that they are being given respect as individual human beings.
But that's...
Nor is this limited to children. It is the first concrete step of the respect that is sought in all interpersonal relationships. Whether in interpersonal relationships at one's workplace, in relationships between lovers, in international relationships, or what have you, we need to have more concern for other people's concerns.
That's impossible! Maybe you aren't aware of this, but those children's concerns include things that are just too depraved. Things that are indecent, grotesque, and offensive. Isn't it our role as adults to show them the right path?
No, it is not. Regarding social feeling, Adler liked to use the following expression. What we need is seeing with the eyes of another, listening with the ears of another, and feeling with the heart of another.
Huh?
Right now, you are trying to see with your own eyes, listen with your own ears, and feel with your own heart. That is why you refer to the children's concerns using such words as depraved and offensive. The children do not think of them as depraved. Then what are they seeing? One starts by understanding that first.
No, I can't. That's just beyond me.
Why?
If we had the same kind of heart and life.
You may have forgotten it, but I remember it well. 3 years ago, you made an assertion that went something like this. None of us live in an objective world, but instead in a subjective world that we ourselves have given meaning to. The issue that we must focus on is not how the world is, but how we are, and how we see the world. And also, we cannot escape our own subjectivity.
Yes, that's right.
Then tell me this. How is it possible that we who cannot escape subjectivity could have the eyes of another, the ears of another, or even the heart of another? If only you would stop playing around with words.
This is a crucial point. It is true that one cannot escape subjectivity, and one cannot become another person, of course. However, one can imagine what appears in other people's eyes, and one can imagine the sounds their ears hear. Adler proposes the following. First of all, think. What if I had the same kind of heart and life as this person? If one does that, one should be able to understand that I would probably be faced with the same sort of task as this person. And from that point, one should be able to imagine further that I would probably deal with it in the same sort of way.
The same kind of heart and life?
Say, for example, that there is a student who never even tries to study. Questioning the student by saying, "Why don't you study?" is an attitude completely lacking in respect. Instead, start by thinking, what if I had the same heart as him? What if I had the same life as him? In other words, one thinks what it would be like if one were the same age as the student, lived in the same household, and had the same friends and the same interests and concerns. If one does so, one should then be able to imagine what sort of attitude that self would adopt upon being faced with the task of one's studies, or why that self would refuse to study. Do you know what this sort of attitude is called?
Imagination?
No, this is what we call empathy.
Empathy? That's what you call thinking about what it would be like to have the same kind of heart and life as another person?
Yes, what is generally thought of as empathy, that is to say, agreeing with another person's opinion and sharing their feelings, is actually sympathy. Empathy is a skill, an attitude that one has when walking side by side with another.
A skill? Empathy is a skill?
That's right. And since it is a skill, it is something that you too can attain.
Oh, well, isn't this interesting? Okay, then I want you to explain it as a skill. How can one know the other person's heart and life, or whatever you call it, anyway? By counseling each person one by one? There's no way you could learn such things.
That's exactly why one has concern for other people's concerns. One must not just observe from a distance. One must dive in oneself. Right now, you are standing in a high place and without ever diving in, making remarks like, "There's no way to do this," or "There's such a barrier." There is no respect in that approach. And no empathy either.
No way. You're wrong. That's totally wrong.
What is wrong about it?
Courage is contagious, and respect is contagious too.
Sure. If I were to run around chasing after a ball together with my students, they might like me more. It might make a good impression on them and give them a feeling of closeness. But if I come down to the level of being a friend to those kids, educating them will be even harder. It's sad to say, but those children are no angels. They're little demons who, the second I go the slightest bit easy on them, will take advantage of me and get too big for their britches, and then they'll be totally out of control. You're living in a fantasy world, inhabited by angels who don't really exist.
I raised two children myself, and there are many young people who come to this study for counseling who weren't able to adapt to school education. As you say, children are not angels, they are human beings. However, precisely because they are human beings, one must pay them the highest level of respect. One does not look down at them, and neither does one look up at them or flatter them. One interacts with them as equals and has empathy for their interests and concerns.
I'm sorry, but that reason for paying them respect doesn't sit right with me. Basically, what you mean by respecting them is just stroking their egos, right? That's exactly the sort of behavior that is degrading to children.
It seems that you understand only half of what I have been talking about. I am not seeking one-sided respect from you. Rather, I want you to teach respect to your students.
To teach them respect?
That's right. By practicing it yourself, you will show them what it means to have respect. Teach them how to build the kind of respect that is the cornerstone of all interpersonal relationships, and show them what a respect-based relationship can be. As Adler tells us, cowardice is contagious, and courage is contagious too. Naturally, respect also becomes contagious.
Courage and respect are contagious.
Yes, and it begins with you. Even if there is no one who understands or supports you, first you must carry the torch and show courage and respect. Your torch will brighten only a few yards around you at most. It might seem like you're on a lonesome night road, all on your own. But the light you carry will reach the eyes of someone hundreds of yards away. They will know then that a person, a light, a path is there, if they go to it. Eventually, dozens and then hundreds of lights will gather around you. Lights radiated by dozens and hundreds of your comrades.
What kind of allegory is that? I'm guessing what you're saying is this. The role that we educators are assigned is to respect the children, show them what respect is, and get them to learn respect. Have I got that right?
Yes. That is where the first step lies, not only in education, but in all manner of interpersonal relationships.
No way. I don't care how many children you've raised or how many people you've given counseling to here. You are a philosopher who's been shut up in his study. You don't know a thing about society or school in the real modern-day world. Look, what people want from school education and what people want in a capitalist society is not this stuff about personal character or some obscure human knowledge or whatever. Parents and guardians and society are looking for real results. And if you're talking about the place where education happens, then the thing we're looking for is scholastic improvement.
Yes, I suppose so.
No matter how much their students might like them, educators who don't raise scholastic achievement will be branded as unfit to be teachers. It sounds just like a money-losing venture made up of a group of friends. On the other hand, an educator who contributes to scholastic improvement with all their students completely under their thumb will be showered with acclaim. But we haven't even gotten to the main issue yet. Even the students who have been thoroughly and continuously rebuked will later say, "Thank you very much for coaching me so rigorously back then," and convey their gratitude. They recognize that it is because of their strict treatment that they kept up their studies, and that my strictness was really a loving whip, as it were. And they go so far as to thank me. How can you explain this reality?
Naturally, I would say that such a story is quite possible. Actually, one might even regard it as a perfect model case for relearning the theories of Adlerian psychology.
Oh, so you're saying it's explainable?
Keeping in mind the discussion we engaged in 3 years ago, let us enter into a slightly deeper place within Adlerian psychology. There are many realizations to be had therein.
Social feeling. A key concept of Adlerian psychology, and the most difficult one to grasp. The philosopher spoke of it as seeing with the eyes of another, listening with the ears of another, and feeling with the heart of another, and said that it requires empathy, which is to have concern for other people's concerns. It made sense, in theory. But was it the educator's job to become someone who truly understands children? Wasn't that just the philosopher playing with language again? The youth glared pointedly at this philosopher who could bring up such words as relearning with little to no explanation.